And today, when you have the entity that provides 60 plus billion of the budgets, saying, hey, we're tapping the brakes. We're gonna cut back here. We're gonna provide less launches for you over there, Space Force, et cetera, et cetera. That ripples through everybody else. Because as of today, those capital markets, those other capital systems aren't yet big enough.
From the Defense and Aerospace Report, this is The Downlink, a podcast about the intersection of space, the space business, and defense. Not just what's over the horizon, but what's happening above it. I'm your host, Laura Winter.
Hey there, podcasters. Welcome to the start of the second financial quarter. This episode's guests, the Downlink podcast, Space Equity and Space Economy Dynamic Duo, Chris Quilty and George Pullen, are going to walk us through what Chris is calling Crazyville. But before we talk about space money, we've got to mark the fact that Assistant Secretary of Defense for Space Policy, John Plum, issued a new space policy this week. It's called the Commercial Space Integration Strategy. He said it's not aimed at the defense industrial base crowd. That's the large corporations we often refer to as primes, but rather at the larger commercial space community. Here's how he opened this announcement.
The 2022 National Defense Strategy directed us to increase collaboration with the commercial sector and leverage its technological advancement and entrepreneurial spirit. Our new commercial space integration strategy follows through on that directive. The degree to which commercial space capabilities and services can benefit U.S. national security will ultimately be measured by how well the department can actually integrate commercial solutions into the way we operate, not just in peacetime, but also in conflict. And to do this, as Secretary Austin has written in the foreword of the strategy, the DoD will need to eliminate the structural, procedural, and cultural barriers to overcoming legacy practices and preconceived notions of how the commercial sector can support national security.
To briefly get an understanding of just what this new strategy is supposed to accomplish, I spoke with Robin Dickey. But first, a quick message from our generous sponsors. This podcast is brought to you by TE Connectivity. When the mission is critical, so are the parts. TE Connectivity's components are exactingly engineered, rigorously tested, and certified by major space agencies. Learn more at te.com/space. Now, here's our conversation with Robin. Hey, Robin, welcome back, and thank you for making the time to come on the podcast.
Oh, thanks, Laura. It's great to be back on the show.
As it's been a while since you've been on the Downlink, Robin, take a moment and briefly introduce yourself. And I think you've got a paper that's come out recently or is about to come out, right?
Yeah. So I'm Robin Dickey. I'm a space policy analyst at the Aerospace Corporation, specializing in everything from national security to international relations and particular norms of behavior in space. But generally, my area touches whenever two different or three different or many different kinds of groups are trying to work together on space policy issues. Figuring out how to get them to work together and agree is where I'm looking. And so the paper that we just published, myself and my colleague Mick Gleason, is on the uses of space in the war in Ukraine, and particularly the role of commercial space actors. So it's very exciting to be here today. I think great timing.
Thank you. I've brought you on this week's episode because the Department of Defense, more specifically, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Space Policy, that's John Plum, he released and briefed the new Commercial Space Integration Strategy. Now, at first blush, this is the strategy of three fours, right? First, it's got four top-level priorities, then four foundational principles, and then third, four key priorities. Now, because this episode is really supposed to be about the first quarter and public and private capital and space investing, I want to avoid getting too deep into the weeds. So, Robin, do us a solid. What is this strategy designed to do for national security and for U.S. national interests in the space domain?
So as a lot of people know, over the last couple of years, there has been an increasing look at the role that commercial space services and capabilities could play in national security and defense. And so this strategy is a really interesting top-level look about how the Department of Defense is considering not just leveraging commercial solutions, which I think was the more popular term a couple years ago. I've had colleagues at the Aerospace Corporation publish on leveraging commercial, but now we're talking about integrating commercial. And that means not just buying satellites or objects, but how do you buy services? How do you interact on a regular basis? And as the strategy describes, at every possible level along the spectrum of conflict. So in all of these different potential conflicts against the broad diversity and complexity of commercial actors, how do they interface with the Department of Defense? And this is trying to give some insight and some structure into how that approach might work.
You know, in this strategy, something that made me raise an eyebrow that I hope you can help me with a translation was the third key priority. That's the section on establishing the security conditions to integrate commercial space solutions. It's received some ink in the dailies, but there's a distinction I'd like to ferret out here, and that is just what the policy directs to protect and secure from aggression. The section that I'm kind of having trouble with reads, and I quote, "The department will leverage a range of tools across all domains to deter aggression against and defeat threats to U.S. national security space interests, including all space segments and, where appropriate, commercial space solutions." And folks out here in the audience, I'm really underlining the word solutions because that's where I kind of start to get a little kind of like, what's that about? Now, I'm quoting again. "In appropriate circumstances, the use of military force to protect and defend commercial assets could be directed. In general, the department will promote the security of commercial solutions." Okay, so what's the difference between space solutions and space assets? And as you and I know, in policy, words are chosen very carefully. Why would this distinction be important?
So, well, I don't know the exact answer to, you know, why one specific word is used in one sentence versus another. The first page of the strategy actually has a definition of commercial space solutions, which is it refers to systems, capabilities, or services operated by the commercial sector. So that kind of goes back to my original point of it's trying to cover a wide range of things commercial might have or do or be. And so I think when the use of commercial solutions is implied so heavily in that approach, it's talking about the whole spectrum of options. And you kind of see that in the sub-bullets to that approach, when it's not just talking about the protect and defend concept that you just read out, but the way that they're thinking about setting these conditions in the security environment is through norms and standards, it's through information sharing, and it's through financial protection. So it's not just what you think about on TV of what it might mean to protect something. There's a lot of things that could be protected, both tangible, intangible. And there's a lot of ways to consider how to do that protection, also both tangible and intangible.
Now, as in all policies or good ideas on paper, the proof will be in its application and administration. Nevertheless, I'm interested to know if anything in this policy document actually surprised you.
So I'm a big wonk for norms of behavior. That's what I spend a lot of time reading and writing about. And I wasn't surprised that norms were included in the strategy because, as you know, in 2021, the Department of Defense released their 5 tenets of responsible behavior. So the department has clearly been thinking about how norms, space, and defense all work together. But I was surprised to the degree to which norms were worked in throughout the whole strategy. Yeah, the idea of acting responsibly and responsible conduct is one of the 4 principles. And then, as I just mentioned, norms and standards are part of how you set the security conditions. They're referred to a lot of different times throughout the strategy. And that's particularly exciting for me because a couple of years ago, I published a paper specifically on how norms can be used to mitigate threats to commercial actors. With this paper and how it's reflected in some of the themes, not to say that they were necessarily reading what I wrote when they wrote the strategy, but the idea that norms can help partners and allies do better in cooperation with each other through cybersecurity standards and other means of helping them help themselves or share information amongst a group. But also strong norms and standards can have some role in dissuading bad behavior, or at the very least, helping you identify bad behavior and respond to it accordingly. So I was very excited to see that in the strategy.
Robin, thank you for making the time to come on the Downlink podcast.
Thanks, Laura. Always great to chat with you.
Now, with the news out of the way, we need to talk about how the commercial space sector and its investors, and more generally, the equity markets, are reacting to the fact that the two biggest consumers of commercial space solutions and products, that's NASA and the Department of Defense, have had their buying power stalled by continuing resolutions and then cut by billions for this year and the next. So here's our conversation with Chris and George. Hi, Chris, George. It's great to have you guys back on the podcast.
Thanks, Laura.
Thanks, Laura. It's great to be back.
Now, before we get into the latest in space, space business, and capital investment trends, let's have you two introduce yourselves. So, Chris?
Thanks, Laura. Chris Quilty. I've been writing financial research on the space industry for over 25 years. Currently through Quilty Space, which is a group of about 10 of us that spend our day living and breathing everything space and specifically space finance.
And George?
Sure. Hi, Laura. Hi, everyone. It's good to be back. So Milkway Economy is a think tank. We provide economic analysis to small and medium-sized space businesses. I also teach at the University of New Hampshire and Columbia, courses on both space, deep tech, and blockchain. And then in addition, Milkway Economy also has a fund where we make some small investments into space companies that we're super excited about.
And George, what do you do at Milkway Economy exactly?
I'm the chief economist of Milkway Economy. I'm also one of the partners. There's five of us who spend a great deal of time working on space and the relay of technologies in the ecosystem.
So again, thank you both for joining me. We've got a couple of tough items to get through in this episode, and the sands of time are running out before the end of the first quarter of 2024. First of all, I'd like to get from you guys what you think are the top, say, two headlines from this first quarter of the year. Is it the effect of Congress's continuing resolutions or the 2024 federal budget? Which just was recently signed into law on Saturday, essentially 6 months late? Or is it that space public equities actually posted gains in February? So, Chris, what moved the needle for you?
Moon mania. This was the first time in my life I've seen people that I know that wanted to talk about things space. Arguably, the two U.S. commercial missions that were carried out during the quarter with Astrobotic and Intuitive Machines. They didn't turn out like planned, but certainly there was some pretty astounding progress in the thought or being able to tell people who asked, like, oh, there's 100 missions going to the moon by the, you know, the end of the decade. And I think most people are shocked to learn that. So I think that was just a great moment for the industry. Putting that aside, I have to mention Starship and the latest launch attempt, but I get a pass on that because George was going to say it. And beyond that, you know, if I pick something commercial that I think probably bypassed a lot of people, though it was kind of a big deal, was SpaceX with their Starlink service won a large contract with John Deere to provide high-speed data, you know, to their farm equipment. And that was a deal that was, you know, pretty aggressively fought over throughout the space industry. And, you know, John Deere ended up handing it to SpaceX. So that's one that's going to have reverberations across a number of different industry verticals.
And what about for you, George?
The thing I would start with, and I will get to Moon Mania. I think it's great Chris brought that up. But one of the things I'd want to start with is the State of the Union. So AKA, that's the annual national address that the president makes to Congress. U.S. citizens, of course, has watched around the world. Usually it's held in January, February. This year it's held in March. That's fine. It's not required to be in January, February. But anyway, the point is that it was no mention made of Space Race 2.0. And things are clearly heating up. And both our allies and adversaries are putting a lot of time and attention into space. And it was just, it was very interesting to me that that wasn't mentioned. And sometimes
he didn't mention that Intuitive Machines had made it to the moon. I mean, that was bizarre. And such, I mean, that's a huge accomplishment.
Yes.
Right.
First.
And it's our accomplishment. Like
first
what's
U.S.
up?
Moon landing, right? First U.S. moon landing of 51 years,
50,
if my math's wrong.
50.
Okay,
actually, 50.
50. I'm like, correct my math. 50-ish years and no shout out. I think, unfortunately, that's probably telling. And so I think that's extremely noteworthy in Q1. I think also if we dig into the math around what Intuitive Machines accomplished, right? So that was part of the NASA's CLPS. And sorry, acronym free zone. I'll remember. Commercial Lunar Payload Service. That sounds right.
You got it. Yay!
we all talk in acronyms all the time, so it's hard to
get a B minus for delivery, man.
Aw, okay. So it was a $118 million NASA contract, and this has enabled NASA to demonstrate that it can have commercial partners putting things on the lunar surface for it. That's a big deal. I think the other big news in Q1 that I followed was the results of the IRB, the Independent Review Board's report about OSAM-1 missions and programs. And that's
OSAM is?
Yeah. And the OSAM-1 mission programs Independent Review Board report was not awesome. They basically said it's going to take 2.3 something billion to make this demonstration a reality.
George, what is OSAM-1?
Sure. OSAM-1 is a NASA demonstration that I believe was planned almost a decade ago now for on-orbit capabilities.
That's servicing and manufacturing.
Yes, and assembly. Right.
Okay.
On-orbit service assembly manufacturing. And the demonstration was supposed to be for refueling and relocation of U.S. government satellite Landsat 7. And now the latest Independent Review Board report is saying that we're still another 4 years away. And if we're another 4 years away, they're saying that it would also cost another $980 million. So just round up another billion to make this thing a reality. Mm-hmm. And I think that saying we're 4 years away from NASA closing the loop on the business case for OSAM, that's a really bad sign for many small and medium-sized companies that I know that are working on ISAM and OSAM projects when NASA's internal reviews done by this independent board are saying that, listen, we're 4 years away from NASA doing it. And that's a really hard way to close a business case, to go back out to your investors, to keep on developing a technology that is that far away from a NASA demonstration.
Well, let's just stick on that OSAM-1 mission just for a quick moment, because Chris, Quilty Space also had a newsletter that also spoke about this, and that there's a little bit more to this story in terms of what the Inspector General found. There's a Maxar side to this, and there's a subcontractor side to this, I think from Tethers. Could you explain what the other side of this story is?
I mean, it's just a poorly structured program gone wrong. And you can blame the contractor, you can blame the government, but it's always the system, right? And I think it's just endemic of a broken system. It's how you end up with, you know, a NASA-designed launch vehicle that costs 1/6 of its budget to launch and is so damn expensive you can't launch it anymore than every 2 years, right? Yep. Contractors did what they were told to do. It was a flawed design. And I think there were, and I'm not a contracting guy, but from the people who I talked to and know, they said, yeah, it was doomed from the failure.
You mean doomed from the beginning?
Yeah, doomed from the beginning. Doomed to failure from the beginning.
Okay.
I was using the shortened version, which obviously confused you.
This is being recorded in the morning, and they all, I think, need a second cup of coffee.
I'm working.
All right. Keep drinking that caffeine. So, George, I want to stay with you for a minute here because I want to get your sense of the general economy and the space economy, that microcosm, because according to the White House, inflation in February, as measured by the Consumer Price Index, was 3.2% over the past year. And that core inflation, which leaves out food and energy prices, is at 3.8% for the same 12-month period. That's led Federal Reserve officials as recently as Wednesday to say they aren't lowering interest rates. Fed Governor Christopher Waller essentially said inflation needs to come down further before he and his colleagues will lower the borrowing rate. And we still have an inverted yield curve, which makes it more expensive to borrow short-term money. So, George, what does this mean generally for the wider economy, and how is this affecting the space economy?
Sure. So, first thing first, keep in mind that what the Federal Reserve does in its setting of interest rates is it gives the rest of the economy something to refer to, and it's a good indicator of how banks are lending to each other and also how banks are lending to companies. And those are companies that are both big and small. Right. So the big ones like Chris Falls or the little ones like iAssist, right? So they all have to face that same capital market structure, which is if I need debt, if I need financial instruments, I have to know what's going on with the federal funds rate because I'm impacted by that. So right now, when they're saying that, you know, we're looking at a period where, well, we don't see a cut now because inflation is so high and maybe later, and that's the worst Fed speak summary I've ever provided, but that's the short version. Well, everyone who was planning on that being baked in, like, oh, maybe I can put off for another quarter. Maybe I can do my next refinancing a little bit further down the road. Well, they're now facing the situation of, can I afford to wait? Are rates actually going to come back to my favor? Maybe they're not. A lot of people still believe that we'll see a cut before November. Those are people who believe the Fed is influenced by politics. I don't personally feel that they are, but some people are saying that. I think it's more likely to assume, and with the Fed, it's always more likely to assume that we'll see more of the same. And so if they can continue to keep inflation only a little hot, right, relatively speaking to where we were, like we're not 7-9% anymore. But if we can keep inflation relatively hot, but under control, they're not in a position where they're going to need to fiddle with the rate. And so all of the early talk this year was that we would see 6, 7, 8 rate adjustments. That is completely gone now. Most people are now talking about 3 or 4 at best. And so that changes the landscape. The other thing is it also continues to be a situation like we saw at the end of last year, where if my capital is safe and I'm able to still go out and get 5 or 6% by doing almost nothing, then as an investor, I will probably continue to have my capital be safe and do almost nothing. And that hurts both small and medium-sized businesses that need to go out and interact with financial institutions, interact with private equity firms and VCs, because they're measured against their performance. And if they can continue to sit on idle cash and it doesn't hurt them, relatively speaking, then they have no incentive to unleash that capital, sometimes referred to as dry powder, onto the market and obviously onto the space companies that we all want to see be successful.
And Chris, how is inflation and the borrowing rate affecting those companies that are publicly traded? You know, as I noted before in February, and this is based on you know, somewhat on your reporting, nearly all the indices were up for space businesses in the way that you cover them. I mean, that's good news. No, but you know, and what's driving that?
Yeah, I, you know, kind of listening to George, you know, brings up schizophrenia, and I think that's where we are in a lot of these equity markets today. I mean, it's just I was trying to come up with a theme, and I couldn't find one. Right.
I'm looking for the couch already.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the challenge here, like, so you got great companies like Iridium and Viasat, you know, longstanding companies where I think Iridium stock is down like 60% off the peak, you know, and there's issues, you can go through them and whatnot. Viasat's trading at like 5 or 6 times EBITDA. I mean, it, kind of crazy valuation, I would argue. Well, it's relative to historically where it's traded in, you know, the teens. I mean, it's just down by 2/3 again. So But then on the flip side, you know, you've got what seems to be a number of, I'll call them new space companies, or, you know, companies betting on the new space economy. They're doing well. MDA won a couple of big contracts on Globalstar and Telesat, and a third one that's announced but not named. I think their stock is up like 2.5-fold. Spire had some interesting announcements and investment partnerships. Their stock is up 2x. And, you know, even a lot of the SPAC companies, you know, they're moving towards profitability. The growth is slowing, as we knew it would. But, you know, some of the business models are probably going to actually work out here, and some could work out really well. So it depends on where you are, you know, in the market. There's a lot of bloodbath and a little bit too much drama in some cases, with a CEO getting fired the week of satellite show. But, you know, all of that said, you know, I think the overall mood, you know, coming back from a week in D.C. is, it's pretty positive. You know, couple years ago, it was like a morgue going to that place, and people were really excited, you know, about opportunities. I think a lot of them have kind of made peace with SpaceX in terms of what it's going to do to their business, and they're pivoting, you know, to find out where they can survive and thrive in a very different world than the one we knew up until a very short time ago.
I want to just kind of go on the schizophrenia bit for a second. I was just kind of wondering, when I was reading the indices, and this is, you know, in a newsletter that came out in February, I'm just wondering, how much does moon mania actually contribute to that? Because it does kind of coincide, no? And I mean, Intuitive Machines, it's publicly traded, and their price has definitely gone up.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, the two, you know, pure play moon companies, both them and iSpace, those stocks are so thinly traded in the post-SPAC period that you can't determine any valuation metric until the stock, more of the float, becomes freely tradable. You know, as it stands now, one or two, you know, buyers, or God help them, a meme. Very memeable, I have to say. But, you know, until that sort of situation settles out, you know, the market will figure out the valuation here. I think a lot of this is speculation.
I love the idea of the float to memeability index. I think that's a new product. There you go, Chris.
Yeah, definitely.
Something that I wanted to mention there on that theme, and it has to do with schizophrenia, is that just to take a quick moment and take a higher view of not just the economy, but specifically the deep tech part of our economy, we have to acknowledge the fact that a lot of the air in the room has been now sucked up by AI and everyone's fascination with AI. And if you think about how deep tech sits in someone's portfolio, deep tech sits in their portfolio because it gives them an exposure to some sort of cutting edge, game changing technology. And that could be space. But right now, a lot of people, in the way they're doing their calculus, that could also be an AI play. And so we should acknowledge that some of the funds that might have gone into space businesses right now are probably actually going to AI businesses right now.
Great point, George.
And if I can follow up on that, you know, I kind of read the daily term sheet of deals priced, and George's not kidding when, you know, 8 out of 10 deals that get priced have the word AI in the description. All that said, I was, when you mentioned that, I kind of pulled some numbers from the spreadsheet here because we haven't finished our, you know, quarterly close on transactions. You know, Q4 of last year, you know, globally in the U.S., in private equity and venture capital, like that was, it's looking like now the trough. Like it had been the worst quarter, you know, in 10 years, and deal volume and, you know, fund performance and capital raised and, you know, deal count, you name it. Everything was hitting lows back half of last year. So arguably we have no place to go up, but I was just looking through some of the deals that got done in the space sector. And I mean, this one's interesting. Deorbit, you know, it's an Italian company that builds an orbital space tug and more. I don't want to mean the tug, but they raised $110 million Series D. Now, A, that is a good sized raise, right? That's real money. Like you're bringing in some big backers. But how about this? They're a failed SPAC company. So they jumped on the SPAC bandwagon, you know, late in the game. And it was April of 2021. Like, that was the death knell when the SEC started squeezing it. And if you kind of missed the early surge and you were on those back end deals, either you had, you know, massive redemptions. I think Spire had 96% redemption of the SPAC money. And all they walked away was, you know, a small amount from the pipe, the committed investors. But, you know, these guys didn't do a deal. Like, they kind of read the tea leaves. They pulled the deal. They went back out in the private markets and raised $110 million, right? So maybe the public markets weren't reading it right. Maybe we'll find out. But just to mention a couple others, Unseen Labs did like a $92 million round. They do radio frequency mapping, you know, similar to what Hawkeye 360 does here in the U.S. Same technology, kind of different customer focus. And then there was an interesting SpaceX-related deal of K2 Space, and they raised $50 million. They're building satellites designed to fit in a Starship. So this is a second derivative business model, and you can think of there's some of the space station companies out there that have also designed their space station to fly on Starship. If Starship doesn't fly, the whole business model falls. So that's kind of where we're starting to move, you know, in this industry, is towards second derivative financial models. So people thinking out in front.
And Chris, also in the past quarter, I mean, there's been some interesting mergers and acquisitions activity. Lockheed Martin is in discussions to acquire Terran Orbital for roughly $600 million. And Iridium is set to complete its acquisition of Satelles. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but that deal is supposed to close in just a few days on April 1st for $115 million. It had a prior 20% stake in Satelles. You are our mergers and acquisitions expert. Anything to see here?
Well, I know way too much because we brought Iridium public back when I was in Raymond James, which was the world's first ever, guess what?
SPAC.
SPAC deal. Yes. Okay. And it was very different in those days. I'm not going. We could do a whole at least a half podcast about the transaction and how you get it done in a market crash. But long story short, originally this technology that they're buying was a $150 million Boeing contract to develop to use the Iridium satellites to prevent GPS jamming. And how relevant is that today? I mean, when I saw that. The chip hit the you know, in Baltimore.
Hit the key. Hit the Francis.
I mean, the thought that came to my mind, it's not this situation. There's a pilot on the ship, but there have been lots of incidences of ships being spoofed on their GPS so that they've run aground, right? This is a relevant technology. So this is going back to the early 2000s, you know, mid-2000s. You know, the Air Force was looking at this issue. And they gave this big contract to Iridium. So long story short, the company that they bought out were the former Boeing engineers that they flipped out into their own private company, and they were commercializing it. But the problem was, you know, and I know the principals there and they're great guys, but, you know, like me, they're running a small business, right? Can you afford to shell out $30 million for a global license from Iridium, you know, to do a global solution? And they couldn't, right? So they were doing sort of piecemeal on the globe. So this is a win-win for both sides. You know, Iridium can light up the whole world with this service now, which they use primarily as a signal integrity. So you have problems. Everything that we use is based upon GPS signals. So military tactical radios won't work. You know, the cellular networks will go down because they're all timed off GPS. And so one thing that Iridium can do is they can send an augmentation signal, you know, to ensure they also have a very long wavelength. So you can, you know, put it inside the data center instead of having to mount on the roof. It's a really cool technology. So that one was logical for them. I mean, they're throwing off so much cash. They don't know what to do with it. And this was actually a really good strategic move for them. What was the other deal?
Lockheed Martin and Terran Orbital. Yeah, $600 million.
Yeah, I guess I would say, I mean, this is why defense contractors do not take minority positions, right? You don't see them buy a minority stake in another public company because the bottom line is they are tremendously dependent on Terran Orbital, you know, for their SDA contracts and timely delivery. And there are a lot of well-publicized issues going on at Terran, and management, it was clearly, you know, you can't keep your eye on the ball when you're distracted by all these other things. It just became, I think, untenuous for Lockheed to wait and figure out how that thing was going to pan out.
I'm now going to turn the discussion to some not so great developments, and that's the federal budget. All right. We had been limping along on continuing resolutions for the past 6 months, barely averting a government shutdown last week, just before the 2024 budget was finally passed and signed into law on Saturday. So before we even think about the 2025 budget request for government space programs, how has the House of Representatives' inability to get the budget done for months affected space businesses? And now that there is a budget which shrinks NASA's budget below the 2023 spending levels, but slightly raises the Space Force budget by $2.7 billion to $29 billion, you know, taken together, there's just less money than what the administration requested, and that means less for the remainder of this year. So how is this shaking out across the commercial space sector? And either one of you can go for it.
I'm happy to jump on that falling knife. So let's see. Oh, here we go. I caught it. So I think it's good to keep in mind that when we're talking about federal budgets for space, it's important that we compare those federal budgets to space to what we get from funding from commercials and what's coming from the banksters and the PEs and the VC firms, right? So that side of the market is somewhere around the $300 billion-ish number over the last decade. And so it hasn't been all even across all those years, but that's about $30 billion a year, if you forgive me for rounding and doing some simple math here. That's about $30 billion a year coming from privates. Again, VCs, private equity firms, banks, going into space companies. Compare that now against the combined budgets that we're now seeing for NASA and for Space Force, which is closer to $60 billion plus together, there's a huge disconnect here, right? The federal government is still the largest buyer, the largest customer, and the supporter of the space economy today. Now, as someone who teaches about space economics, I do firmly believe that that will not be the case going forward. I think that we are in a transition period where more and more the ecosystem is going private, where more and more companies will have private sources of revenues and funding. But that's not the case today. And today, when you have the entity that provides 60 plus billion of the budgets saying, hey, we're tapping the brakes. We're gonna cut back here. We're going to provide less launches for you over there, Space Force, et cetera, et cetera. That ripples through everybody else. Because as of today, those capital markets, those other capital systems aren't yet big enough to balance out a U.S. government and Uncle Sam pull back, or at least a foot off of the gas. I'm not going to say they're tapping the brakes, but at least a foot off the gas is what we've seen.
Yeah. I mean, I just say maybe to be a little more pedestrian, the budget cycle's tough, right? I mean, this is, I listen to earnings calls all the time, and I hear it time and again, you know, these companies have some key program and it's delayed and pushed off. And, that has an impact on the industry. Their ability to grow, attract talent, everything like that. So what I would love to see is, you know, a clean budget. I mean, I don't think they've done those in a year, or is it decades at this point? But the issue really becomes the new starts. So while you're in a continuing resolution, by budget law, you're not allowed to start a brand new program. And so if you think of things like building a nuclear, you know, new class of nuclear submarine, and it gets stuck behind a CR, and you have this strategic program that's getting held up for, you know, pedantic legislative reasons. So, a little more budget certainty. But, you know, when I look at where money's going, I mean, recently for the Earth observation industry, both, NASA and the DOD started buying more imagery, you know, from the commercial industry. I don't know what NASA's using it for, but like, great. And then, you know, in other cases, you're seeing, you know, some of the big, large funded programs like, you know, SLS and Orion continue to just you know, suck up the budget. And so I think there's larger structural issues. I mean, clearly that NASA and the government have to deal with. But in the near term, I mean, a 1-2% budget cut is kind of like what we're looking at, where they would have wanted to grow 3-4%. You know, if you go through that for one budget cycle, nobody's, you know, no major harm will be done.
Yeah, but if you couple that with inflation, if inflation, especially core inflation being 3.8%, you know, if it only grows by 2% in numbers, that's still below the rate of inflation, right? That means the buying power is still going down, which means there's less money to go around, yeah. Right? I mean, it's a cut at the end of the day.
Yeah. And it's certainly a cut, and it's not the type of thing that anyone not following the news won't detect. Right. We all know where inflation is. We all know how impactful it's been on businesses, both within the space sector, but also across the economy. And when we see budgets that aren't in line with even keeping up with it, then it's a cut. It just is. I think the second order impacts here are that we can spend time going through line by line and, you know, who's winning and who's not among probably the larger players and primes. But we also have to remember that this trickles all the way down to their subs and to the companies that are servicing those subs and providing ancillary technologies or have business cases related to what they're doing. It's going to impact all the way down the system. And so it's that old expression, right? When the U.S. goes into a recession and, you know, catches a cold, the rest of the world will get pneumonia, right? It's that same idea that when we have a situation where budgets are being pulled back, or at least not keeping up with inflation, they're taking their foot off the gas. Maybe they're tapping the brake. Maybe they're not. We can debate that. But then program by program, sure, the primes, they'll keep doing what they do, right? And the larger behemoth programs that are around for whatever reason are going to keep chugging along. But when you really get down into the weeds on how that's going to impact their subs and how that impacts the people with business cases to support that next innovation, they're out in the cold. And that is not a good place to be if you're a small or medium-sized enterprise.
That also has knock-on effects in terms of the development of capabilities, right? I mean, when we say innovation, we could just sort of translate that forward, at least for the Space Force and possibly for NASA, but we're talking capabilities. And I know for NASA, I mean, they recently laid off a number of people at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, again, because of budget constraints and problems like that. I've never heard of JPL laying anybody off before, like ever. But I hate to pile on this, but we also have next year's budget, right? Because that also came out, the presidential budget request for 2025. And I just don't see a budget for 2025 getting passed until after the presidential election. I mean, if we, you know, look back at our recent history as being, you know, the foretelling of what's coming in probably the pretty immediate future, that we may not even get a budget until after a president is even sworn in. You know, how is that going to affect the fabric of the commercial space sector, you know, or this way of governing by continuing resolution?
Get used to Crazyville.
Yeah. So I think we should keep in mind just for a second, and this is maybe trying to put something positive here. Maybe I'm searching, but something
I'll
that
find it, please do, because yeah, I'm do think that this is pretty, you know, this is pretty sour, and this isn't even sour grapes. This is just, you know, this lurching from continuing resolution to continuing resolution. I don't understand how, you know, young companies that might have contracts through SpaceWorks or what have you, you know, how they can go to investors or potential investors who are going to quite rightly say, well, yeah, that's great, but is the money going to be there?
So I think one of the things to think about that we have coming up, so this is now looking forward versus, you know, looking to what happened in Q1, Intuitive Machines second mission, right? IM-2, that's scheduled for November. And so there's a real chance that Moon Mania continues to pick up steam between now and then, and gets another, you know, huge shot in the arm on the second mission. I think the other thing that is important when we think about the larger space economy is that the U.S. isn't the only one participating, right? So we've got India doing all kinds of things. And their Prime Minister Modi has made it very clear in several public addresses the importance of space, the importance of space technology, how space is part of India's future. They've been very clear about this. Remember, they're the ones who went to the lunar South Pole last year, and it only cost them $75 million for that trip. So they have big plans. They have their first human spaceflight mission planned next year. Also over in Asia, among our allies, you see Japan, right? So last year they doubled their defense spending, and very predictably that had a positive impact on space and how much they're spending on space. We did, of course, see the, I think it's Kairos, right? Space One's Kairos rocket did explode. But, you know, they've got a lot of Japanese support, and that's a Japanese company trying to send a first Japanese satellite to orbit. And that's going to continue. And so while we might see a little bit of a bend in the trend line here stateside, I think if we look across the oceans, we see, you know, our allies like India and Japan continuing to do more and quite frankly do more with less than we spent in space.
Yeah, and it happened last week, so I didn't read all the details, but Japan just passed a big new billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar space investment program.
Yep.
So
they started it's essentially a space nonprofit venture capital fund. It's an amazing idea. And so what they're doing with it is they've identified government funds to go out and then invest and reinvest into private space companies. And it's done essentially at arm's length through this pass-through mechanism. Boy, it's a shame we could do something like that here.
Yeah, really.
I'm being tongue-in-cheek, Laura. You know, we talked about this in a different podcast, so I'm not going to rehash my feelings on that, but they're strong.
Yes, we do. And yes, they are. So last thoughts. We need to wrap this up. What's coming in the second quarter that we should look out for? Chris, go for it.
Inflation and interest rates, right? I feel coming into this year, 2023 was kind of a crappy year, feeling pretty good. But, you know, if we get like a high inflation print and then suddenly the Fed decides, okay, we're not cutting rates this year, you know, all that in default commercial real estate, you know, loans out there that have been hanging on for the cuts. Well, maybe then they finally start foreclosing and then you get a whole commercial real estate bubble crash. And that's not the scenario I want to see. But, you know, there are those sort of black swans out there. And, you know, short of that, you know, I'd like to see a fully successful Starship flight. And I'd like to see somebody actually touch down with all four legs on the moon.
Oh, Chris, that's a good one. I think for the rest of this year, I think some of the things to look forward to. I do think Chris is right. I think the energy at the conferences is much improved from 21, 22, 23. People are definitely excited and they're moving with alacrity. I don't think that was the case before. And even though the government budgets might not be reflecting it here stateside, I do think that the space companies that are still around are very excited. You know, Orlando was supercharged.
It's the schizophrenia setting in.
Right. I mean, I'll be in Wisconsin next month for their National Security and Space Summit at Concordia. That should be a good event. A lot of great speakers there talking about what they see happening for the rest of this year. I think in addition, you've obviously got other major, you know, space events coming up where people are going to be making announcements during those. You know, Space Foundation has theirs. I think that will be interesting too. Like, what sort of news releases do we see coming out of there? Do we see more positive than we did last year? Do we see more volumes of releases than we did last year? It's a big time for news. And so I think that's something to watch for the rest of this year. I agree with Chris on the economic outlook. I'd like to avoid any black swans. But remember, black swans are actually normal in Australia. It's the white swans that are weird. So, you know, we'll see what happens next. I think on the other thing being positive here is something Chris also mentioned, which is that the business cases revolving around Starship. We can, you know, go back and forth about the technical merits, the technical achievements, but at some point, people who have those second and third order business cases, they're going to need to have a Starship that does a full demonstration for them to close their business cases. And I don't know what that timeline looks like, but if I know my small and medium-sized space company runways, I do know it's usually about 18 months to 24 at the most. So the clock's ticking down, and hopefully we see some more success this year from Starship.
George, Chris, thank you both so much for making the time to come on the podcast.
Always a pleasure.
Always a great deal of pleasure, Laura. Thank you so much.
That's it for this week. For your daily dose of award-winning defense coverage, listen to the Defense and Aerospace Report with Vago Maradian. And for the maritime domain, listen to Cavas Ships with Chris Cavas and Chris Cervello. And get your air domain news and analysis from the Air Power Podcast with J.J. Gertler and Vago Maradian. I'm Laura Winter. Thank you for listening.